ua mau te ea o ka aina i ka pono.
Queen Liliuokalani was the last reigning monarch of the Hawaiian Islands. She was deposed by opposition forces who called themselves the Committee of Safety with the help of the U.S. Marines. On January 17, 1893, Queen Liliuokalani yielded her authority. Quote, "Now, to avoid any collusion of armed forces and perhaps the loss of life, I do this under protest and impelled by said force yield my authority until such time as the government of the United States shall, upon facts being presented to it, undo the action of its representatives and reinstate me in the authority which I claim as the constitutional sovereign of the Hawaiian Islands." Tonight on Circle A Radio, we discuss Hawaiian sovereignty with Portland author Eleanor Langer and Dr. Kakuni Blaisdell, convener of the Pro-Hawaiian Sovereignty Working Group. Stay tuned.
What you want? Yeah. Hawaiians, tell me what you need. Yeah. Trying to take what the Kanaka Moli got. Yeah. Just to satisfy the government's greed. Hawaiians, tell me what you want. Yeah. Kanaka Moli, tell me what you need. Yeah. We must never forget what our kupuna taught. Yeah. Even if I have to bleed. The educator, mana o deeper than a crater. You should have known by now that I'll be back sooner or later. With even greater, mana you know they didn't wanna ever go down while they see us rising like an elevator. But it's time for the indigenous uprise. I see the fire burning in the children's eyes. Another freeway, another heiau dies. It's time to make the government joke on their lies. The term Hawaiian homes is a joke to me, cause every piece of land is Hawaiian homes to me. But in order to be a residential, blood must be 50%. Whoever thought of that law is an idiot to me. So we're living on the beach and you call us squatters, because we're living off our own land, fishing from our own waters. I promise our fight will never be over. Just try and run us over with your damn bulldozer. I rap for my people, I cry for my people, I live for my people, I die for my people. What you see is what you get, take me as I am. And I ain't never had an uncle named Sam. To all my people, tell me what you want. Hawaiians, tell me what you need. Trying to take what the Kanaka Maoli got, just to satisfy the government's greed. Hawaiians, tell me what you want. Kanaka Maoli, tell me what you need. We must never forget what our kupuna taught.
This is Eleanor Langer. She is a Portland writer and a member of the Nation editorial board. She was instrumental in putting together a special issue of The Nation, published April 28, 2008, about the issues of sovereignty and indigenous rights of Native Hawaiians.
My interest in Hawaii came in the mid-90s on a family visit to Hawaii, to Maui, in reading a travel book that said something like, in 1893, American business interests overthrew the Queen, and they all lived happily ever after. And I remember, I described this in the Nation article, I really remember the exact moment driving down a highway and seeing a real garish town of Lahaina on the right and this falling down sugar mill, which in fact is not there anymore, on the left, and thinking, no way, it didn't happen this way. These people were not happy about this. I immediately started collecting books, including the Queen's autobiography, Hawaii's Story by Hawaii's Queen, but couldn't get to them for a long time because I was working on another book. Eventually, when I got to them, I found the story of the annexation of Hawaii and the continuity of the struggle against the domination of Hawaii by outside forces. Extremely compelling story, and became sufficiently involved in it to spend the next couple of years writing what became the special issue of The Nation, called Famous Are the Flowers, Hawaiian Resistance Then and Now. And I want to say, too, that I'm going on with this work. That special issue of The Nation was published in April 2008, but I am now actually writing a biography of the Queen, tentatively titled In Search of Liliuokalani.
Can you tell us about the reign of Queen Liliuokalani and what her main goals were in ruling Hawaii and who was in opposition to these goals?
Liliuokalani was queen for only a short time. She inherited the throne in the fall, I believe, of 1891, when her brother, David Kalakaua, died. Kalakaua had been king for a long time. He'd been king since 1874. It was in Kalakaua's reign that the real tension and hatred of the monarchy by the American business interests arose. These business interests had tried and, in fact, succeeded in basically humiliating Kalakaua and in curtailing his powers somewhat via an event, a kind of coup, in 1887 that is known as the Bayonet Constitution, because he was forced to sign, literally at bayonet point, a new constitution curtailing these royal powers, which neither he nor the citizens, the native citizens, I should say, were ever happy about. So the power struggle was completely in place when Liliuokalani succeeded her brother. These business interests were basically looking for a chance to topple the monarchy, really. And they saw it in her ascension and were nominally provoked by her efforts to rescind the Bayonet Constitution and to restore the former balance between native and white power in the government and in the country. So it was the Queen's decision to promulgate a new constitution, which she did on the basis of signatures on, I don't know how many, thousands probably, of petitions from the Hawaiian people. She wanted to redress the balance, and they used that moment to challenge her power. They claimed that she was the one who was doing something illegal, but really she was trying to restore or undo something illegal that had been done earlier in the reign of her brother.
Because her reign was much shorter, was that why they picked that moment, or did it have anything to do with her being a woman as opposed to the king, or was it just sort of the timing?
I would say that it was the act of attempting to retrieve monarchical power. I mean, since they had already done it, actually already challenged Kalakaua, I think no matter who had succeeded Kalakaua, had they taken the same step that Liliuokalani took, the same thing would have happened. So I don't specifically attribute it to her being a woman. On the other hand, she does seem pretty lonely amidst all the men, you know, who basically have the economic authority and the economic power, and in many cases, the governmental power. I mean, it's not unusual in Hawaiian history for women to be powerful. Women, in fact, were powerful in Hawaiian history. But at that point, she is the only one around of anything like her stature. And her husband, who is a very arguable character in any case, had died just before or just as she was coming into power, I think, just around the time her brother did. So she really didn't have anybody that she was close to, women or men, to trust, you know, to count on, to advise her. She was pretty isolated.
And then you mentioned the hatred of the monarchy by the business people, but what was the opinion of the monarchy of the Hawaiians?
They loved it and love it to this day. Hawaii became a country only at the very beginning of the 19th century. But under the name of the ruler who we all know is Kamehameha. And there were five Kamehamehas between 1809, I think, and 1874, or five rulers from that dynasty. And then the Kalakaua line, which consisted only of Kalakaua and Liliuokalani, came in 1874. But there was intense loyalty to the concept of the monarchy and the person of the monarchs, which isn't to say there wasn't sometimes, you know, court fighting, as there always is when power is involved, but the love of the monarchy was and is very strong. It's the embodiment of the unification of the islands, and it was the preserver and holder of the nature of Hawaiianness. It exemplified what it was to be Hawaiian. And they didn't have much else because everything else was being taken away, was falling away. So the monarchy was extremely important.
And can you tell us about the overthrow of the monarchy and the establishment of the provisional government? What was the response of the Hawaiian people?
The actual moments, the actual drama, I should say, of the overthrow took place in about 4 or 5 days, starting, I believe, January 14th, 1893, and began with this attempt of the Queen to promulgate the new constitution. She was forced to withdraw that effort because of the threat of the coup, which then took place. At the moment she was forced to withdraw it, she went out and she told her people, to whom she had promised this new constitution, I'm talking about throngs of people in front of the building, that she was not going to do it now, that she was going to do it later. She was going to keep her promise, but she wasn't going to do it right then. And I think at that point, when the people went home peacefully, and I think the Queen attempted to go back to the palace or to her home, which is also right nearby, that's when the men planning the coup mobilized. And in that period is when they got in touch with the American minister, his name was John Stevens, and arranged with him that they would land troops from an American ship that was in the harbor, as they always were in the harbor, so that the coup on the part of the people who became the provisional government was really inseparable from the force supplied by these American Marines who came ashore. I mean, people argue about exactly what came first, but roughly speaking, it happened at the same time. What the provisional government wanted and assumed would take place was immediate annexation to the United States. They thought that all they had to do was do this and they could present Hawaii on a silver platter in Washington and it would be accepted and that would be that.
And Eleanor, at that time, how did the Hawaiian people respond to what was happening with the overthrow of their queen?
They pretty much did what the queen told them to do. They were certainly respectful of the queen's strong wish to avoid bloodshed. And I think that when the queen told people to go home, they went home. And they basically let her make the decisions for them. The time that Hawaiians became the most active was shortly after that, in the period between the overthrow of 1893 and the annexation of 1898. In that period, virtually the entire native population was actively opposed to annexation and signed petitions, which were only recently found in the National Archives and displayed actually in Honolulu. And in fact, you can now go into a bookstore in Hawaii and buy these petitions bound, which have the signature of virtually every living Hawaiian on them against annexation. And there were a lot of quiet acts of resistance as well. The reason that my special issue of The Nation is called The Famous Are the Flowers is that that is the translation of a very famous and very beloved Hawaiian song. In Hawaiian, the title is Kalana Na Pua, Famous Are the Flowers. It grows out of a moment when the provisional government tried to wrest, I suppose, the loyalty of its native subjects by forcing anybody who was on a government payroll to sign a loyalty oath, and that included members of the Royal Hawaiian Band, which is kind of a sacred institution at that point. The members of the band said, no, we won't sign your oath. We don't care if our salary is cut off. We will eat stones, which is actually another translation of Kalana Naupua. So it's sometimes called the stone-eating song. And this became a resistance song then, and has been revived at several points, most recently and powerfully in the 1970s when the sovereignty movement was reborn. There was also, if we're talking about Hawaiian resistance, there was also an attempt to restore the queen to the throne. That was a military attempt in 1895. So between the overthrow and annexation, there was an armed resistance movement on the part of Hawaiians. And it was that led to the queen's imprisonment. The queen was charged with advance knowledge of the plot to restore her. And she was imprisoned in her former palace for what was supposed to have been a long time, I think initially 5 years or something. I think she was there less than a year, but she was still in prison.
You are listening to Circle A Radio as we talk with Eleanor Langer about Hawaiian sovereignty. She wrote in the special edition of The Nation about the strong identification of the Hawaiian people with the monarchy. Quote, a few weeks after the coup, a musical friend of Liliuokalani's was asked by members of the Royal Hawaiian Band, who had refused to sign the new government's petition for annexation to the United States, to write them a song that would express their loyalty to the Queen. You will not be paid, you will have to eat stones, is what they were told. The result was Kaulana na Pua, famous are the flowers. The pua frequently also translated as children or descendants, but always meaning something growing out of and belonging to the land. Some of the lyrics in the song include, famous are the children of Hawaii, ever loyal to the land, when the evil-hearted messenger comes with his greedy document of extortion. No one will fix a signature to the paper of the enemy with its sins of annexation and sale of native civil rights. We do not value the government's sums of money. We are satisfied with the stones.
Like in a lot of coups, we're talking about a group of business interests who are on the ground in the actual place where the coup is going on. But what was the role of the U.S. government throughout this period from the time of the overthrow to annexation and then from annexation to statehood?
Let's take the shorter one between the overthrow and annexation. The Hawaiian coup, the emergence of the provisional government, arrived smack in the middle of the debate in the United States over imperialism. There were still very strong anti-imperialist convictions in Washington and around the country. There were people who believed that the United States should not extend its boundaries beyond the continental borders. Now, you might say there was a lot of imperialism on the part of the United States before Hawaii. You can interpret the westward expansion of the United States in that way, although it's certainly not always done. But regardless of how you see the westward expansion, there still was something first about Hawaii. It was a discontinuous entity. It was out in the middle of the ocean. It was almost 3,000 miles from California, which was far itself from Washington, from the east in those days. So the attempt on the part of the Americans on the ground in Hawaii to get themselves annexed right away didn't work the way they wanted it to. There were divisions in the government. I mean, there had been people all along. The U.S. president at the moment of the coup was Benjamin Harrison, and he was an expansionist. And his Secretary of State, James Blaine, was an expansionist. And many people in Congress were, but many, many were not. And the coup occurred after the election of Grover Cleveland. Harrison was a Republican. Cleveland was a Democrat. Cleveland was anti-expansion. The coup occurred after the Democrat was elected, but before he took office. Inauguration in those days was in March. And Cleveland sent out to Hawaii one of the major unsung figures of American diplomatic history, a former Confederate but now a retired U.S. congressman from Georgia named James Blount, who landed in Hawaii, interviewed everybody, concluded that there had been illegal American intervention, and recommended strongly against annexation, was in favor of restoring the Queen. And Cleveland took Blount's recommendations, but he did not have the power to persuade the entire Congress to go along with him. I mean, he would have put the Queen back on the throne. He wanted to. Cleveland was appalled by this first instance of American power in the way that we're all unfortunately too familiar with now. But in any case, the forces in favor of restoring the queen were not as strong as the other side, and it kind of hung in balance for the years between 1893 and 1898, and was only jogged into a full annexation by the outbreak of the Spanish-American War in 1898. At that point, a lot of things came together to weaken the opposition in Congress to annexation, the strategic location of Hawaii in particular, because we were sending troops to the Philippines and they really needed a place to stop. So even though the strategic importance of Hawaii had always been noted, it was suddenly an acute necessity and the opposition fell apart. But it's important to register that there was never any formal annexation of Hawaii by the U.S. The opposition in Congress diminished to the point where a congressional resolution could be passed authorizing annexation, but there was no treaty of annexation. There never was and never has been. So there was a lot going on domestically here between 1893 and 1898 that very strongly affected the outcome of the coup in Hawaii.
And so what happened to the Blount Report during that time?
The Blount Report, which, by the way, is on the web, amazingly enough, all hundreds and hundreds of pages of it, was discussed in newspapers and magazines and argued about. And it was eventually challenged by another report called the Morgan Report that was the outcome of hearings by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Chairman was an Alabamian named Morgan, who had a different view that has persisted through history of the legality of the movement against the Queen. They argued back and forth again in this crucial period, really, for American foreign relations. Should we be a world power or should we stick within our borders? Hawaii was right in the middle of it.
Was there a fight about statehood? Was that ever brought up as an issue at that point?
The statehood issue almost comes out of a different legal framework. It's something really worth paying attention to because we are at, in 2009, we are at the 50th anniversary of statehood. And there are going to be both state-sponsored celebrations and demonstrations against it. The legal framework of statehood has to do with the United Nations and the decolonization processes that were set in after World War II. So it's not really quite the same national framework. Hawaii was on the list of UN non-self-governing territories in 1945 or 1946. And because it had become a territory, I mean, we skipped from 1898 annexation to 1959. But in any case, as a territory, it was on this list, this UN list. So it would have been subject to or up for decolonization. But a referendum was organized, I guess you'd say. It did not give Hawaiians who voted the option of independence. There were two choices, I believe, on the referendum. I think it said either it should be a state or it should continue as a territory. So that did not give them the option of voting for independence. So that's a whole other legal framework within which the present situation of Hawaii is debated.
So you talked about the sovereignty movement being reborn in the 70s. Do you want to talk about how that happened and if it was a response to anything in particular, just sort of the times?
I think a lot of it was the times. I mean, there was a good deal of awareness, I think, in Hawaii of the civil rights movement in the United States and what became the Black Power movement. I mean, there was a kind of general stirring of identity, I suppose you'd have to say, of suppressed people. And in Hawaii, it actually wasn't that long between the overthrow and annexation and the revival. I think what's important to understand that we have not talked about yet, though, is the extent of both the decimation of the Hawaiian people, the literal decimation of them in the 19th century, and the cultural assault on them as Hawaii became more and more accessible to the mainland, more and more part of the United States. So the combination of the smallness of the population, direct cultural assault, and the demoralization that set in the 19th century, in part because of the deaths, and the inseparability of the biological and the cultural decimation, let's say, left the people very weakened and not at home in their own home. But at the same time, there wasn't that much time. I mean, there was, what, 60 years. So there were still pockets of people around. There were a few people who still spoke the language. There were a few people who had carried on or certainly still held sacred, even if they didn't carry on the sense of their native selves. And somehow that got reawakened, maybe starting in the 60s and starting in the 70s. Another big factor in reawakening was that as Hawaii became more integrated into the mainland economy, more people came, more buildings started, there were a lot of physical dispossessions of Hawaiians from such communities as they had, and there began to be long and drawn-out protest movements over evictions. It's very well documented photographically, both in still photographs and in videos. So in a place called Sand Island, which is in Honolulu, Kalama Valley, which also I think is probably technically part of Honolulu, another place on the highway, the dislocations were immense given the scale of the island, and that mobilized a lot of people. So there's the sort of the more purely cultural revival, the active protest, and then there began to be musical revivals. Kalana Napua is only one of many resistance songs that spread around. Probably the most famous Hawaiian musician, a gorgeous song called Hawaii 78, clearly written in 78, that said, what would the kings and queens feel if they came back and saw the highways, if they saw the buildings? How would they feel? It was really still an extremely powerful song. And then there were three absolutely major developments. One is somewhat intangible. It's a serious effort to reclaim the language, which is now going quite well. The language had virtually died after being outlawed in 1896, but there are now, thanks to this part of the revival, this Hawaiian immersion schools. And there's serious Hawaiian language study and recovery through the university at both Manoa and Hilo. And then two other things. One was the rebuilding of the Polynesian voyaging canoe. And now it's canoes, it's plural. But there was belief, which I think was pretty much disparaged for a long time, that the Polynesians were great navigators. And they were great navigators. And when the Hawaiians recovered and they basically demonstrated the advanced navigational skills of these ancient Polynesians who were their forebears, that was a very stirring and thrilling recovery. And it also was a very communal recovery. I've had people make this point to me. This is not an elite recovery because the number of people involved in the actual reconstruction was huge and required integrated effort of a really profound kind. And finally, I have to put the occupation of the 8th Hawaiian island, which most Americans have never heard of but is really there. You can see it on the map. It's called Kahoolawe. It's near Maui. It is an island that had people on it in ancient times and had been taken over by the Navy in World War II as a bombing practice, as a target zone, actually, and didn't have any people living on it by that time, but was still sacred land and uninhabitable, full of mines and God knows what. And there was a concerted effort to reclaim Kahoolawe with night landings and some occupations and some very tragic deaths along the way, but eventually successful, as the voyaging canoe voyages were and are successful. The occupation of Kahoolawe is successful, and the island has been given back to the people. The federal government's relinquished control over it. It's given back to the state, and its reclamation is progressing. So there were major recoveries all through the 70s and 80s and 90s, I guess, and continuing. A great revival.
We are in the middle of an interview with Portland author Eleanor Langer, and we will also hear from Dr. Kekuni Blaisdell about Hawaiian sovereignty here on Circle A Radio, broadcasting on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and www.kboo.fm. Jumping forward again a little bit, can you talk about Clinton's apologizing to Native Hawaiian people in 93 and what the next steps are towards recognizing the overthrow and making amends for it?
The apology resolution, which was signed in 1993, 100 years after the overthrow, was a response to the cumulative power of the what you call the Hawaiian Renaissance or the renewal of Hawaiianness. You know, there were many ways to describe it. And particularly at one point on the actual days of commemoration of the overthrow, it brought thousands of people, many, many thousands of people into the streets of Honolulu for an actual reenactment of the 5 days of the overthrow. And it was state-sponsored. The American flag was down. The Hawaiian flag was up. The feeling was indescribably broad and indescribably intense. I say indescribably, but you can see it again in photographs, both still and video, what the immensity of this commemoration was. I think that made people in Washington in general, and Clinton in particular, you know, more sympathetic to the idea that something needed to be done. I think the apology resolution really, it came from within Hawaii, from the congressional delegation and from all the people who were filtering up to the congressional delegation. But it was signed by Clinton, and it's a wonderful document. I hope everybody listening will read it. It's essentially a recapitulation of Hawaiian history from the Native point of view. And I think an accurate point of view, and states flatly that the overthrow and American participation in it was illegal. So that was a great moment. But since then, people have been arguing about what the implications of this apology are. I mean, on the one hand, it acknowledges that the annexation of Hawaii is illegal. On the other hand, it basically says, you know, we're sorry, but it doesn't say what we're going to do about it. It ends, nothing in this joint resolution is intended to serve as a settlement of any claims against the United States. So it's a statement of fact. It's a really eloquent statement of historical fact, pretty much landing with the thud of not doing anything about it.
Can you talk a little bit more about how that came about and what prompted that?
There were groups of people in Hawaii who were, of course, among the activists and among the scholars. And we didn't talk about the recovery of history, but there's been a movement, as there is for the recovery of language, in the recovery of Hawaiian history. And I think this idea had been around for a while, that the United States should sign on to an accurate version of Hawaiian history. But I can't tell you the exact chain by which it went from the scholars to the churches to the congressional delegation to Clinton. I don't know that.
Can you tell us more about ceded lands, what's going to be argued in front of the Supreme Court next year?
The heart of the matter, the heart of everything that has to do with the legality of the status of Hawaii is about land. The provisional government that overthrew the Queen seized public land that was in two forms, or had two rubrics, I guess you'd say. One was called crown lands and one was called government lands, but they were all, in a sense, public lands. That was 1.8 million acres of land. So seized from the Queen, turned over to the U.S. at the time of annexation. And that land is still very much in legal question. It really is the heart of the possibility, or impossibility, I think you'd have to say, of sovereignty, because it is the most valuable land in Hawaii. It is the land that includes the airport, includes the university, includes land. Hotels are on its, you know, golf courses are on the land or the island. So does the United States have a claim? Who has the claim to this 1.8 million acres? And that's what's being argued about. There's recently been a scholarly book about it, which is going to be the sort of Bible on the subject, called Who Owns the Crown Lands of Hawaii? We're missing a step, not one I can do a great job on, but the premise of the apology resolution is that there would be some kind of, the phrase is reconciliation. Toward the end of the apology resolution, it says, Congress urges the president to acknowledge the ramifications of the overthrow of the kingdom and to support reconciliation efforts between the United States and the Native Hawaiian people. And the reconciliation efforts are generally thought to mean something to do with the recovery of this land or the renegotiated status of the land. And yet, the claim that it's illegal is very easy to defend. In fact, I would say that there's a sort of common oddity in the Hawaiian story in that If you look at Hawaiian legal claims, whether you're looking at the land, let's say Native Hawaiian legal claims or sovereignty movement legal claims, whether you're looking at the land, which is a domestic issue, you're looking at international law, the legal case that the Hawaiian activists can make is very strong. You can lay it out brilliantly, and it is laid out brilliantly, both on the land issue and particularly on the foreign policy, the international recognition, the illegality of the overthrow issue. You can find many places where it's laid out. And yet, you come to this point where these brilliant, accurately laid out, irrefutable legal claims don't lead to anything. Or then you have to ask the question, and of course they are asking the question, how do we make it lead to something? We're right, then what? There's a kind of analogy, I think, between the land issue and this whole recognition issue.
Another thing that we didn't really address is the role of the U.S. military and the land.
Well, just that it's enormous. And just because land is so central to the issue here, the fact that the military controls, I think it's almost 6% of the land of the island as a whole, but almost 25% of the island of Oahu. That is to say, there's actual military installations covering practically a quarter of Oahu. The military occupation of these lands is very omnipresent. That's an issue, and also environmental issues coming in part from the military occupation are very strong. So there's a real intertwining of sovereignty issues with military and environmental issues, something people might want to sort of pay attention to.
And kind of coming back around to you talking about that family trip where you had a sense that something wasn't quite right, how can we as leftists support the struggle for Hawaiian sovereignty?
Well, you know, I'm really glad to try to talk about that one because I think that there are ways. One of the things you can do is if you go, try to find out by looking at these various websites what events are happening that you might participate in or observe or support while you're actually there. Now, for instance, well, just today, I guess, or yesterday, there were demonstrations in both Oahu and Kauai about sort of a technicality, and yet it isn't, the state's effort in the Supreme Court about the ceded lands issues right now. So if you were there, it would be very interesting to go to those or to hang out around them and see, to talk to the people. They're, you know, not everybody's friendly. I mean, not everybody's interested in mainland support, but a lot of people are. I would go to those events. I would really urge people who are doing anti-military work here, environmental work here, to try to make their own contacts with the groups there, which you can do, you know, via the web. Just find out what they're doing because there's, of course, real overlap. I would say just reaching out with goodwill and seeing what happens.
I'm Ke Kuni Blaisdell, and I'm Kanaka Maoli, which is our ancestral name for us natives in our homeland called Hawaii. I'm in the Western world, Professor Emeritus, retired professor of medicine in the University John A. Burns School of Medicine here in Honolulu. But I became involved in the sovereignty or Kanaka Maoli independence movement in the 1980s when I first became aware of the serious health and social and economic plight of our people and came to the realization that this was due to United States domination and exploitation and colonialism in our homeland. So I began to educate myself and joined others in the Kanaka Maoli independence movement in the mid-1980s. A big event was in January of 1993, And at that time, that was the 100th anniversary of the United States taking of our homeland, that is, overthrow of Queen Liliuokalani, who was our ruler at that time. Troops from the USS Boston landed in Honolulu and faced Iulani Palace, the home of the Queen, and local white, with whom we call haole, businessmen, took control of the government with support of the U.S. minister at that time and demanded the abdication of our queen. But she did not abdicate, rather in the face of force and the support of U.S. troops. She yielded her authority in a succinct statement, not to the local white oligarchy, but to the United States, until such time as the United States, upon investigation, would restore or reinstate her as sovereign of the constitutional monarchy of Hawaii. So on that centennial, 15,000 Kanaka natives gathered at Iulani Palace in Honolulu to protest that event of 100 years previously. And then in August of that year, we held a People's International Tribunal and brought the United States to trial for its crimes against our people and nation. And we were able to engage 9 eminent authorities on international law to be members of this tribunal. We were able to bring specific charges against the United States. The major one was one I've already given you, and that is in 1893, the United States illegally taken our government, and then also taken, stolen all of our lands, and subsequent to that, engaged in the illegal annexation of our homeland to the United States in violation of treaties and international law. The recommendations from that tribunal included United States immediately recognizing the right to self-determination of our people and re-inscription of Hawaii on the United Nations list of non-self-governing territories and return of all of our lands. And then in November of 1993, just 3 months later, the United States Congress passed the United States Apology Resolution, Public Law 103-150, in which the United States officially apologized for its role in the overthrow of our monarchy and the taking of our lands, and admitted that the United States had violated our right to self-determination and our inherent sovereignty. So that has added weight to our push for independence since then. But the United States Congress, instead of following through with the recommendations of our tribunal, has resorted to what is now known as the Akaka Bill in the United States Congress, submitted 8 years ago in the year 2000, which in effect creates a puppet government for us as wards of the United States, and a puppet government to report to the Secretary of the Interior. That is, we become like an Indian tribe, American Indians and Alaskan Natives. So our efforts are now, have been devoted for the past 8 years and continue to be devoted to opposing the Akaka Bill in lieu of our goal, which is independence. So that's a summary of our movement.
I think to some outsiders, the Akaka Bill is being presented as this gesture to recognize Hawaii. Can you talk more about why it is not an appropriate answer and why it is important to defeat it?
Yes, the Akaka Bill was drafted and introduced by Senator Daniel Akaka, who is the junior senator from Hawaii in the United States Congress. So this legislation comes not from us, but it comes from a United States senator. And it was introduced, continues to be introduced, but has not yet passed the Congress over the past 8 years. In order, it is said, to protect us, and by us, in the bill, we are known as Native Hawaiians in the Akaka Bill. And as Native Hawaiians, we are identified in that bill as indigenous to the United States. We are not indigenous to the United States. We are indigenous to our own homeland, and we are not legally part of the United States. So we oppose much of the language in the bill, as well as the intent, and that is to render us analogous to American Indians and Alaskan Natives in order to protect us from a series of lawsuits that have been lodged against us in our homeland, lawsuits for what is called Native Hawaiian preference. So in 1978, for example, Hawaii State Constitution created an Office of Hawaiian Affairs to promote the well-being of Native Hawaiians, and the trustees of that office to be so-called Native Hawaiians, to be elected by so-called Native Hawaiians. So a group of white right-wing conservatives brought a suit against the governor and the state of Hawaii for giving preference to Native Hawaiians. And the United States Supreme Court at the end of 1999 sided with those right-wingers. And so, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs now is open to non-natives. Since then, that same group of right-wingers, who are locally known as the Grassroots Institute and promoting so-called aloha for all, have continued to bring suits against Hawaiian trusts, such as the Kamehameha School, which were founded in 1887 under the Hawaiian Kingdom by a descendant of Kamehameha the Great, who inherited his lands and the income from those lands support the Kamehameha schools for Kanaka Maoli children. So the Grassroots Institute has sued the Kamehameha schools for giving preference to Native Hawaiians, contending that that's a violation of the United States Constitution. So that case, again, is being reconsidered by the U.S. Supreme Court. So we in our own homeland, formerly a separate nation recognized by the international community, are now being sued by right-wingers for giving preference to our own people in our homeland, when we have the worst health, social, economic conditions of all ethnic peoples in our homeland. So this is why we have to oppose the Akaka Bill, and our only alternative is complete independence from the United States. So the United States has to withdraw from its illegal occupation of our homeland.
What would you like to let people know about how outsiders can support the struggle for sovereignty in Hawaii?
Well, the most effective way is to reveal and promote the truth, that is, the truth of these historic injustices against our people and nation. So the United States and the world community needs to be informed of these injustices. And these, as I've pointed out, are not only violations of Kanaka Maoli law and U.S. law, but also international law. So this needs to be brought to the international community and to the United Nations. But we do not have membership in the United Nations. And our representation there is limited to the permanent forum on indigenous issues, which meets once a year in New York. We meet with the other indigenous peoples of the world, only a relative few of which are seeking independence, which of course is our goal. So we have to be distinguished from the other indigenous peoples in that we seek restoration of our independence as a separate country. And the right-wingers in the United States make the argument that Hawaii is a state, and therefore independence means secession, and secession means civil war, and therefore this cannot be tolerated. Secession is also violation of the U.S. Constitution. So people of the United States as well as the international community need to be aware of the falsity of that argument. We were a separate nation, a separate kingdom, with treaties with the United States and other nations, and the United States illegally occupied and took our country and annexed us by resolution of the U.S. Congress, because the treaty which had been drawn up between the White Republic of Hawaii and the United States was then able to muster 2/3 majority vote in the U.S. Senate to ratify the treaty. So there was no treaty between either the Republic of Hawaii, which was a puppet government, or the Kingdom of Hawaii. There was no treaty. There was merely a joint congressional annexation resolution, which is domestic law. And therefore, on the grounds of international law, Hawaii was not properly annexed to the United States. That was an illegal action. So, people of the United States and the international community needs to be aware of these historic facts, and aware of these historic facts needs to indict and officially find the United States guilty of its illegal annexation and illegal occupation of our homeland, and to bring pressure on the United States to withdraw from its illegal occupation of our homeland.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to our guests, Eleanor Langer and Kekuni Blaisdell. For more information on Hawaiian sovereignty on the web, Eleanor recommends HawaiianKingdom.org and FreeHawaii.info. For updates on environmental justice, Kahia.org, K-A-H-E-A.org. And the American Friends Service Committee in Hawaii, AFSCHawaii.org, has more information on demilitarization and other social justice programs in Hawaii. Big thanks go out to the original Hawaiian Rapstas, Sudden Rush, for allowing Circle A Radio to use their beats and conscious lyrics on tonight's show. You can link up to their webpage and other resources from tonight's show when you visit www.kbo.fm/Circle A Radio. Circle A Radio airs the first and third Wednesday of every month on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 in Portland. We love hearing from you. Get in touch with us by emailing circlearadio@gmail.com. Our next show will air on Wednesday, January 21st, from 6 until 7 p.m. We'll be talking with author and activist David Bacon. Thanks for listening.
We must never forget what our kukula taught. Yeah. Even if I have to bleed.
Hey, yo, they think it's a battle zone, but it's damn sure right, cause it's yo. Also my home, and I'm prepared to fight. I reminisce about the past and the present. Obviously, the other color didn't listen. So let me break it down like division and fraction. It's time to take position and counter their action. Cause if they're doing this, then we be doing that. But if they're doing that, then we be doing this. Don't get my people pissed, cause it turns real radical. We're nothing like a rush right in front of the capital. Supporting sovereignty, we're all the same kind. Ready or not, believe me, they gon' try to cross a line. But it better not be mine, or the back of any kind. Yeah, yo, I done try to stand up for what's mine. I write another rhyme or whatever it takes to accomplish all these dreams I was made up in the mix.
Yeah. Do all my people tell me what you want?
Yeah.
Hawaiians, tell me what you need?
Yeah.
Trying to take what the Kanaka Maori got?
Yeah.
Just to satisfy the government's greed. Hawaiians, tell me what you want?
Yeah.
Kanaka Maori, tell me what you need?
Yeah.
We must never forget what our kupuna taught.
Yeah.
Even if I have to bleed.
Office, here he is,
warriors.
I put you the mist. Tell me how you feeling this. It's dynamite, and I'm ready to ride. Despise the crooked man, so I'll sever my tie. Ain't no strings attached, y'all know. I keep it mellow while you tripping. Pulling the strings like you's a pedal, Mr. Sam. You the man, acting like you give a damn. I ignite and fight for my homeland. I'm pulling weight in my car. I'm me and Baka rocking with the spoon in my car. I'm ducking at the clock, yeah, with styles is bent. Let me disperse this verse for Mr. President to represent. Tell me where the justice went. Your lack of compensation is insufficient. Can't run from the past, can't hide from the truth. And I still ain't wearing no soldier boots.
Do all my people tell me what you want?
Yeah.
Hawaiians, tell me what you need?
Yeah.
Trying to take what the Kanaka Maori got?
Yeah.
Just to satisfy the government's greed. Hawaiians, tell me what you want?
Yeah.
Kanaka Maori, tell me what you need?
Yeah.
We must never forget what our kupuna taught.
Yeah.
Even if I have to bleed.
The Hawaiians out there, all the people living in Hawaii, along.